I want to continue in volume two and take up at April the 26th, 1899. And here the Lord is speaking about detachment. He will bring up this subject over and over again because it's one of the vital lessons in life. We cannot leave this earth with any baggage that isn't spiritual. And so we have to learn how to be detached from people and things and ourselves and our own opinion and all kinds of stuff if we're to be free enough to be able to be in the divine will. Today, while my beloved Jesus was making himself seen, it seemed to me that he was sending me many flashes of light which penetrated all through of me, through all of me. When in one instant I found myself outside of myself together with him, and the confessor was there. She has had this experience before, that in an out-of-the-body experience, she can experience the confessor and the Lord together. Immediately I prayed my beloved Jesus to give a kiss to the confessor and to go into his arms for a little while, because Jesus was showing himself as a child. To make me content, immediately he kissed the confessor on his face, but without wanting to detach from me. I remained all afflicted, she said. And I said to him, my little treasure, my intention was for you to kiss not his face but his mouth, so that touched by your most pure lips, it might be sanctified and strengthened from that weakness. She's referring to something that Jesus and herself understood. In this way, it will be able to announce your holy word more freely and to sanctify others. Oh, please, I pray you to make me content. So Jesus gave him another kiss on the mouth, and then he said, I am so very pleased with the souls who are detached from everything. Not only in the affect, but also in the effect. Okay. Not only in the doing of their works, but also in the results of their works. And as they keep stripping themselves, my light keeps investing them, and they become like, just like crystals. That means that the light can shine through them, such that the light of the sun finds no impediment to penetrate inside of them, unlike buildings which are thick and heavy and other material things. So we have to be detached in order to become spiritual. Then he added, ah, they think that they strip themselves, but instead they come to be clothed not only with spiritual things, but also with corporal ones, because my providence has a care, all particular and special for those detached souls. My providence covers them everywhere. It happens that they have nothing and yet they possess everything. That's what St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 6:10, that as having nothing, we possess all things. Now, the problem that most of us have is that we don't trust God really to provide all our needs. So we make absolutely certain that we provide them ourselves. And then we wonder why we don't have a testimony that other people have who let stuff go and trust in God absolutely to take care of them. After this, we withdrew from the confessor and we found many religious people who seemed all to have their goals set on working for their own interest. You see, they're not trusting God. Passing through their midst, Jesus said, woe, woe to one who works for the purpose of gaining money. You've already received your recompense. Okay. Now, it's not what it looks like. In Italy in those days, families insisted on priests running their businesses for them, because the priest would be trusted as being honest, whereas they wouldn't trust anybody else. And so they pulled priests away from their vocations and got them totally involved in commercial things. And then the priest became attached to things and he got wealthy and his vocation is destroyed. So that's what he means by working for their own interest. And if they're only interested in gaining money. It's a terrible danger for someone like a priest or a bishop or a cardinal to be given property and money, and then they get involved in the whole commercial world. So May the 2nd, 1899, how all heaven is veiled in the church. This morning, Jesus aroused much compassion. He was so afflicted and in suffering that I wouldn't dare to ask him anything. We would look at each other in silence. Every now and then he would give me a kiss and I would kiss him. And he continued to make himself seen in this way several times. On the last occasion, he made me see the church, telling me these exact words, "All heaven is veiled in my church." Just as in heaven, God is the head, and there are many saints of different conditions, orders, and merits, so in my church, in which all heaven is veiled, the Pope is the head, and the sacrosanct Trinity is veiled even in the triple tiara that covers his head. And there are many members who depend on this head, that is, different dignities, various orders, superior, inferior, from the littlest to the greatest. They all serve to embellish my church. Each one, according to his degree, has the office entrusted to it. And by the exact fulfilment of the virtues, it comes to give from itself a splendour so very fragrant to my church that the earth and heaven are perfumed and illuminated. And the people are so drawn by this light and by this fragrance that it is almost impossible for them not to surrender to the truth. I leave it to you then to consider those infected members, which instead of shedding light, they cast darkness, how much torment they cause my church. So this is the reason why Jesus shows himself all afflicted and everything. He's illustrating for Louisa the damage that is being done to the church through sin and through getting involved in worldliness and self and all the rest of it. While Jesus was saying this, I saw the confessor near him. Jesus stared hard at him, just as he did to the rich young man in the gospel, do you remember? With his penetrating gaze. Then he turned and he told me, "I want you to have full confidence in the confessor, even in the smallest things. So much so that there must be no difference for you between me and him. And according to your confidence and faith in his words, so I will concur." So there's Jesus telling her to have absolute confidence in this priest, and that, in other words, she could trust that God was guiding the priest to guide her. Now, who is this priest? The confessor from 1898 to 1922 is Father Gennaro Di Gennaro, a huge influence on Louisa's life. He's not canonized, though. The only one of her confessors who was canonized was Annibal de Francia. So in the very act in which Jesus was saying these words, I remembered about certain temptations of the devil, which had produced a little bit of distrust in me. But Jesus, with his vigilant eye, immediately corrected me. And at that very moment, I felt that distrust being removed from within my interior. May the Lord be always blessed, who has so much care for the soul, so miserable and sinful. So May the 6th, 1899, Louisa looks for Jesus among the angels. This morning, Jesus hardly made himself seen. I was feeling my mind so confused that I almost could not understand the loss of Jesus. When I felt surrounded by many spirits, maybe they were angels, I cannot tell with certainty. While I was in their midst, every now and then I would investigate. Who knows, I might feel at least the breath of my beloved. But as much as I did, I found nothing that would reveal the presence of my loving good. Then all of a sudden I felt a sweet breath coming from behind my shoulders and I immediately cried out, "Jesus, my Lord." And he said, "Louisa, what do you want?" Now I want to remind you that in John chapter 20, verses 1 to 10, on Easter day, Mary of Magdala went looking for Jesus. She wanted him so badly that when she met the angels, she paid no attention to them. It's very interesting. Also, when you go to the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 5, you have the spouse in the Song of Songs searching for her beloved so much that it doesn't matter who else she meets, she has no interest in them whatever. And that's the same with Louisa here. Jesus, my beautiful one, Louisa said, come, do not remain behind my shoulders, for I cannot see you. She desperately needs to see him. I've been waiting for you and investigating for the whole morning. Who knows, I might see you amid all these angelic spirits that surround my bed. But I couldn't, and therefore I feel very tired, because I can find no rest without you. Come, we will rest together. So Jesus placed himself near me and sustained my head. Those spirits said, Lord, how quickly she recognized you. Not even at your voice, but at your mere breath, immediately she called you. And Jesus answered them, she knows me, and I know her. That's John 10:14. My sheep know my voice, and they recognize me. She is so very dear to me, like the pupil of my eyes. And while he was saying this, I found myself in the eyes of Jesus. Who can say what I felt being in those most pure eyes? It's impossible to manifest it with words. The very angels remained astonished. So May 7th, 1899, here we come to Purity of Intention. In the first four volumes, this with the detachment, this subject is brought back time after time, because it is so essential for us making a successful journey in the divine will. So while I was doing my meditation during the day, Jesus kept making himself seen near me, and he told me, my person is surrounded by all the works that souls do, as by a garment. And the more purity of intention and intensity of love that they have, the more splendor they give me. And I will give them more glory, so much so that on the day of judgment, I will show them to the whole world. So let the whole world know how my children have honored me and how I honor them. That's the first book of Samuel, chapter 2, verse 30. Those who honor me, I will honor, says the Lord. Assuming a more afflicted air, he said, my daughter, what will happen to so many works, even good ones, done without purity of intention or simply out of habit or self-interest? What shame will not fall upon them on the day of judgment in seeing so many works good in themselves, but made rotten by their bad intention, bad understood, such that their very actions, instead of rendering honour to them as they would to many others, will give them shame. In fact, I do not look at the greatness of works, but at the intention in which they are done. Now, that's an extremely important point, and Jesus will come back to it time and time and time again to make sure that we understand that we could do all the projects on the planet. But as St. Thérèse of Lisieux said, that picking up a pin off the floor out of pure love for God is worth all the projects on the planet. It's the love content that makes all the difference to God, because God is love. He said, this is where all my attention is. So Jesus then kept silent for a little while, and Louisa said, I kept thinking about the words he had spoken to me while I was meditating within my mind, especially on the purity of intention and on the fact that when creatures do good, they must disappear, making the creature one with the Lord himself, as if creatures did not exist. So I want to give you John 3:30 there. He must increase and I must decrease. Now, in the divine will journey, we have to decrease to the point of nothingness so that he can increase to the point of allness in us. Then Jesus continued, saying to me, yes, it is so. See, my heart is so very large, but the door is very narrow. Now that's Matthew 7, verses 13 to 14. No one can fill the void of this heart but souls who are detached, naked. That nakedness now is your own self put aside and all your self-interest and everything to do with self. And simple, simple meaning uncomplicated. Okay. In fact, as you see, since the door is small, any hindrance, even the slightest, that is a shadow of attachment, an intention that is not upright, a work done without purpose of pleasing me, all of this prevents them from entering in order to delight my heart. Much love of neighbour enters my heart. Now, there's a VIP point. The only thing that enters his heart is love. That is love for God, love for neighbour. Much love of neighbour enters my heart, but it must be so united to mine as to form one single love. Now, that is John 13, verses 34 to 35, that you are to love one another in the same way as I loved you. That is absolutely, unconditionally, with utter forgiveness. And also John 15, 9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. And that is the way that you are to love one another. So the love must be united to mine to form one single love in such a way that one cannot be distinguished from the other. But as for the other love of neighbour, which is not transformed into my love, I look at it as something. I do not look at it as something that belongs to me. So it's only the divine love with which we love God with his own love and we love our neighbour with God's love. That's the only love that actually means anything. Human love is ephemeral like the weather. It comes and goes. May the 9th, 1899, the threat of chastisement. This morning I was in a sea of affliction because of the loss of Jesus. After much hardship, Jesus came and drew so close to me that I couldn't even see him. He reached the point of placing his forehead upon mine, of leaning his face on mine, and so with all the other members. So this complete oneness. Now, while Jesus was in this position, I said to him, my adorable Jesus, you don't love me anymore. It's totally extraordinary, that. And he coming to give her this extraordinary intimacy. He said, if I didn't love you, would I not be so close to you? And Louisa said, well, how can you say that you love me if you no longer let me suffer as before? I'm afraid you don't want me to be in this state anymore. At least free me also from the bother of the confessor. Now, Louisa has a thorn in her side. And the thorn in her side is that the confessor must come every single day to release her from the stiffness that her body goes into when she's in ecstasy. She can't release it herself. She's willing to suffer the crown of thorns, to be crucified, to carry the cross, blah, 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 but not this. If you want to know what your cross is, all you have to do is look at whatever it is in your life that you would give to anybody, anywhere, anytime, under any condition, finito. That's your cross. A cross is unbearable. And this is what Louisa had. But she never recognized it as a cross. It's amazing. And very often the things that cause us the most pain are unrecognized either. It's very interesting. It may be a struggle that you have inside of you. It may be a difficulty you have in a relationship. It could be anything. It could be illness that you don't want. It's something that's really challenging you at the core of your being. So Louisa said, while I was saying this, it seemed that Jesus would not pay attention to my words, but rather he made me see a multitude of people. In other words, he deflected her attention, who are committing every kind of evil. Indignant with them, Jesus would make different kinds of contagious diseases swoop down into their midst, and many would die black as charcoal. Now, if your soul is as black as charcoal, you're not going to heaven. And it doesn't appear that you're going to purgatory either. It seemed that Jesus would exterminate that multitude of people from the face of the earth. That's Revelation 11, 18. I will destroy the destroyers of the earth. While seeing this, I prayed Jesus to pour his bitterness into me so as to spare the people. But he wouldn't pay attention to me in this either. And replying to the words I had said before, he said, the greatest chastisement I can give you, the priest and the people, is to free you from the state of suffering. In other words, Louise is going to discover, but only in volume 6, when Jesus tells her that the whole of Europe is on her back And yes, there was going to be two terrible wars, but they would have been infinitely worse if she wasn't carrying out her role as victim soul. So Louisa has to stand in the breach between the justice of God and the sinfulness of man. That's Psalm 106, verse 23. There's also a passage in Isaiah where the prophet complains that there was nobody to stand in the breach. My justice would pour out in all its fury if there was no victim soul, understood, because it would find no opposition. This is so true that the worst evil for someone is to be given an office and then be removed from it, because there would be a terrifying judgment for her that she was asked to love her neighbour like this and she was refusing to do it. It would be better for him that he had not been admitted to that office, since by abusing it and not profiting from it, he has rendered himself unworthy of it. Oh dear, remember Judas. He was called to very high office. He was given all the privileges of that office. He preached Christ. He worked miracles for him. And he betrayed him and lost his soul. Then Jesus continued to come quite a few times today, but so afflicted as to move one to pity and to tears, maybe even the stones. We'd say to move the stones to tears, yeah. I tried to console him as much as I could. At one time I would embrace him, and then at another I would sustain his head, which was in great pain. Or I would say to him, "Heart of my heart, Jesus, it has never been your usual way to appear so afflicted to me." In other words, you made yourself so afflicted by pouring it into me. If other times you made yourself seen afflicted by pouring it into me, you would immediately change appearance. But now I am being denied the opportunity to give you this relief. Who would have thought, after you had consented to pour and to share your sufferings with me for so long, that you yourself did so much to dispose me, that now I would be deprived of it? Suffering for love of you was my only relief. It was suffering that made me bear my exile from heaven. But now, being deprived of it, I feel I have no place on which to lean anymore, and life becomes tedious. Now, sitting in a bed doing nothing and having no distractions, tedium is definitely a word that you would use. You'd go off your head completely. Oh, please, oh, holy spouse, beloved good, my dear life, oh, please let the pains come back to me, give me suffering. Do not look at my unworthiness and at my grave sins, but at your mercy, which has not exhausted itself. While I was pouring myself out with Jesus, he drew closer to me and told me, "My daughter, it is my justice that wants to pour itself out onto creatures. The number of sins in men is almost complete." Now, this is only 1899. What would it be like in the third millennium? I want to give you Genesis 15:16. The cup of the Amorites is not yet full. And when the cup of iniquity is full, that's when chastisement comes hot and heavy down on top of us. The number of sins of men is almost complete, and justice wants to come out to make pomp of its fury and to find reparation for the injustices of men. Look, to show you how embittered I am and to content you a little bit, I want to pour only my breath into you. And so, drawing his lips near mine, he sent me his breath, which was so bitter that I felt my mouth, my heart, and my whole person being intoxicated. If his mere breath was so bitter, what must the rest of Jesus be like? He left me with such pain that I felt my heart pierced through. In other words, he's letting her know what he means by the cup of iniquity is almost full. He only gave her one breath of it, and it was intolerable for her. We have no idea what sin is like. We've no idea the effect it has on heaven, on the Lord, and the damage it's doing to the earth itself. You might know something intellectually, but to know it is to grasp it in the depths of your soul. I think we'd all be doing reparation morning, noon and night if we understood. So May 12th, 1899, Jesus makes her content, pouring sweetness and bitterness from his side. This morning, continuing to make himself seen afflicted, my adorable Jesus transported me outside of myself and showed me the various offences that he was receiving. Now notice, receiving in the present tense. That's 1899. I began to pray again that he would pour his bitterness into me. At the beginning, Jesus did not pay attention to me, and he just told me, my daughter, only then is divine love perfect, when it is done for the sole purpose of pleasing me. He says charity, and I'm saying divine love to make sure you understand it's not just human love. Only caritas or agape, they're the Latin and the Greek. When agape is really perfect, it's when it's done solely for the purpose of pleasing me. So if you want to make an act of pure love, it has to be only and absolutely to please Jesus, for no other reason. Otherwise, it's not taken as a complete act of love. And only then is it called true charity. And is it recognized by me when it is stripped of everything? That is, stripped of self-seeking, stripped of wanting recompense from human beings, stripped from needing praise, stripped from needing thanks, and all the rest, and all the rest. So I want to give you John 5:44, where Jesus told the scribes and Pharisees that they were looking for human recompense and therefore they were getting none from heaven. Also in Matthew chapter 6, at least verses 1 to 10, you have Jesus saying that because of the way they were praying, they had got their reward. There would be no reward coming to them from heaven. And the way they were strutting about and looking for the honour and glory of human beings, there was no honour and glory due to them from God. Sad. So taking the occasion from his very words, Louisa said to him, Jesus, my dear, it's precisely for this that I want you to pour your bitterness into me, to be able to relieve you from so many pains. And if I pray you also to spare the rest of the humans, it is because I remember well that on other occasions, after you had chastised them, in seeing you suffer so much from poverty and other things, you too suffered very much. Oh, sorry, in seeing them suffer as a result of the chastisement, you too suffered. That's like saying a parent who has to chastise a child when the chastisement's really needed, they don't enjoy it. And they don't enjoy the unhappiness of the child. And they don't enjoy the atmosphere that is created. They don't enjoy any of it. They only enjoy it when the child is happy and fulfilled. On the other hand, when I have been attentive and I have prayed you and importuned you to the point of tiring you so much so that you were pleased to pour it into me, sparing them, afterwards, you have been very content about it. Don't you remember? Besides, are they no longer your images? That's Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 5:3 and Romans 8:29 and 2 Corinthians 3:18. Seeing himself persuaded, Jesus told me, because of you, it's necessary to make you content. Draw near me and drink from my side. That's the great wound in his side. So I did, Louisa said. I drew near him to drink from his side, but instead of bitterness, I suckled a most sweet blood, which inebriated all of me with love and with sweetness, because the whole of redemption is in the precious blood of the Lamb, as St. John tells us in his letters. Yes, I was content, but this wasn't my intention. She wasn't looking for that. So turning to him, I said, my dear good, what are you doing? What comes out is not bitter, but sweet. Oh, please, I pray you, pour your own bitterness into me. And Jesus, looking at me kindly, told me, keep drinking from bitter, for the bitter comes afterwards. Now, the interesting thing is that both in the Old Testament and in the book of Revelation, I'll give you Revelation 10, 9, when the prophets were told to eat the scroll, they found it sweet initially, and then it turned bitter in their stomach. And what that meant was that they enjoyed receiving the word of God. But when the reality of what the word of God meant for human beings and they were to deliver it, it was going to cost them an awful lot of pain to deliver an unwelcome message to an unwilling audience. And most of the prophets were martyred as a result. So Louisa said, I attached myself to his side again, and after the sweet kept coming for a while, the bitter also came. But who can say the intensity of the bitterness? Afterwards, I was satiated from drinking. I got up and looking at his head, which had the crown of thorns, I removed it and I drove it onto my own head. If this lady can be called anything, she can be called very courageous. Jesus seemed to be all compliant, while other times he had not permitted this. How beautiful it was to see Jesus after he had poured his bitterness. He seemed almost disarmed, without strength, all meek like a humble little lamb. In other words, this is the power of the victim soul to change justice into meekness. I realized that it was very late, she said, but since the confessor had come early in the morning to call me to obedience, it wasn't that I knew that I was to be called by obedience, for at the obedience Jesus leaves me free. So turning to him, I said, most sweet Jesus, do not allow that I cause trouble to my family and bother to the confessor by having him come again. There's the thorn in her side. Oh, please, I beg you, you yourself let me return into myself. And Jesus told me, my daughter, today I do not want to leave you. And Louisa said, I too do not have the heart to leave you. But just for a little to let my family see that I am inside of myself, and then we will return and be together. So after a long differing, so here they are disagreeing together. OK, so this is a sweet little row between two spouses. Saying goodbye to each other, he left me for a little while. It was precisely lunchtime and my family was just coming to call me. But even though I felt I was inside of myself, I felt all full of suffering. My head would not hold up. That bitter and that sweet which I had drunk from the side of Jesus gave me such satiety and suffering together that it was impossible for me to take anything else. The word I had given to Jesus kept me on tender hooks. So with the pretext that my head was aching, I said to my family, let me be alone, for I don't want anything. So I was left free again. And immediately I began to call my sweet Jesus, and he, always kind, came back. But who can say what happened to me today? How many graces Jesus gave to my soul? How many things he made me understand? It's impossible to express it in words. Then, after staying for a long time in order to calm my sufferings, Jesus poured sweet milk from his mouth. Now, a lot of the saints and mystics have had this sweet milk, and it seems to be a fortifying food. And I remember saying to a class recently, I don't understand this milk. And immediately the Lord gave me an image of the milk. And that it is that when an infant sucks its mother's breast, it is receiving life from its source, because the mother was the source of that life. And when Jesus gives milk from his mouth to the saints, they are feeding directly from the source of life. And he's strengthening them for all that they have to suffer. So he left me then, giving me his word that he would come back soon. And so I found myself inside myself again, but a little more free of sufferings. Now, it's on a day like that that Louisa is completely spoiled. Jesus is with her most of the time, And there's wonderful things going on between them. So as soon as he has to pull back and give her a little bit of privation, then she goes into an absolute tailspin. So May the 16th, 1899. This is the power of the cross and stripping oneself of one's own will. So this is a VIP message. You need to put VIP on it because it is absolutely central to the journey of the divine will. Jesus continued for a few more days to manifest himself in the same way, not wanting to detach himself from me. It seemed that that little bit of sufferings he had poured into me attracted him so much that he couldn't be without me. This morning he poured a little bit more of bitterness from his mouth into mine, and then he told me, "The cross disposes the soul to patience." Now, anyone who's been through a long trial, you will know that. The thing you learn is patience. And patience means long suffering. And long suffering means L with a mile, O with another mile, N with another mile, and then G. It really means long suffering. Most people are very impatient and they go mad if they're left waiting a moment even. Nowadays, they're so used to machines that if the machine doesn't operate instantly, they absolutely say, "I'm waiting ages," and it mightn't even be a minute. They have no patience at all. Now, the cross disposes the soul to patience. The cross opens heaven and it unites heaven and earth together. That is, it unites God and the soul. The power of the cross is very great. And when it enters a soul, it has the virtue of removing the rust of all earthly things. Not only this, but it causes her boredom, bother and contempt for the things of the earth, giving her instead the flavour and the enjoyment of celestial things. So one of the great things that the cross does is to heal us of our attachment to earthly things and to turn us around and redirect us towards heaven. However, few are those who recognize the power of the cross and therefore they despise it. So I want to give you Matthew 16:24. Peter absolutely rejected the cross when he heard it. And then Jesus told him that the cross was for every one of his disciples. In other words, many of the saints have said that a Christian without a cross is an anachronism. Who can say how many things I understood about the cross while Jesus was speaking? Jesus' teaching is not like ours, in which one understands only so much of what is said. Rather, one single word of his contains immense light because Jesus is the creative word of God. That's John 1:1-5. So every single word of his leaves an immense light. And to ruminate well on it, one could remain occupied the whole day in the most profound meditation. Therefore, if I wanted to tell everything, it would be too long, and I would also lack the time to do it. So after a little while, Jesus came back again with a little more afflicted. I immediately asked the reason for it, and Jesus showed me many devout souls. Now, that usually means priests and religious. That means hierarchy, priests and religious. And he told me, "My daughter, what I look at in the soul is when she strips herself of her will. Only then does my will invest her, divinize her, and make her all mine." Now that is VIP. The motto that we have to have in the Divine Will Adventure is, "Not my will, but thine be done." And if we're not stripping ourselves on a daily basis of our will, the Divine Will cannot take over. It's actually that simple. If I have a cup full of tea, I cannot drink water. I have to pour out the tea to put the water in, or vice versa. So if I want to be filled with divine will, the human will has got to step down. And so if we're not doing that, you can say all the prayers you like in the divine will, but you are not on this journey. On this journey, you strip yourself of the human will to let the divine will take over. Take a look at these souls, Jesus said, who call themselves devout, as long as they get things their own way. But then, one little thing, if their confessions are not long enough, if the confessor does not satisfy them, it's enough for them to lose all peace. And some reach the point of no longer wanting to do anything. This says that it's not my will that predominates in them, it is their own. Believe me, my daughter, that they have taken the wrong path. That's Matthew 7, verses 13 to 14. Because when I see that they really want to love me, I have many ways to give grace. How pitiful it was to see Jesus suffer for this kind of people. I tried to sympathize with him as much as I could, and so it ended. Now look, let me give you an example. I've given retreats for more than 40 years. The people who come on retreat are nuns and priests and brothers and lay people who are committed to the Lord and they want to grow in holiness. So they are the devout, these people that the Lord is talking about here. And my experience has been that while they want to go on retreat, they won't keep the silence for you. They want the best rooms. They will complain if the standard isn't high enough. They complain if the food isn't the best and if the portions of food aren't big enough. They want the best seats in the hall where you're speaking. And I just look at it and say, they're deceiving themselves. They think they're seeking God, but they're not. They're not seeking God. If you're looking for your own comfort and for all the advantages that you can possibly get in a situation, you're not seeking God. You're seeking yourself. And if you're seeking yourself, forget about divine will. Divine will won't enter. And so the very basic step is that we've got to set aside our own will and the seeking of self and the seeking of comfort for ourselves. We've got to set that aside and seek God for himself alone. So we now come to May the 19th. 1899. This is a very important message as well, and it's one of the foundational messages. You see, in volumes 1 to 4, you get all the foundational messages. Some people think you can start reading these volumes at higher volumes, but if you don't have the foundation stones, you may not actually reach divine will. This morning, I felt a fear within me that it might not be Jesus, but the devil who wanted to deceive me. Jesus came, and seeing me with this fear, he said to me, humility is the safeguard of celestial favours. Do you remember Blessed Mother in the Magnificat in Luke chapter 1? He who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And she described herself as his lowly servant. Okay. Humility is the safeguard. It's the only safe place we can be in the spiritual life. Humility clothes the soul with such safety that the tricks of the devil cannot penetrate into her. Humility places all celestial graces in safety, so much so that when I see humility, I let flow abundantly all kinds of celestial favours. Therefore, do not want to disturb yourself for this, but rather with a simple eye, look always into your interior to see whether you are invested with beautiful humility, and do not worry about all the rest. Then he showed me many religious people, and among them priests, even of holy life. But as good as they were, they lacked that spirit of simplicity. Now that's Matthew 18, verses 1 to 4. The simplicity is a different word to the word that's used out in the world, simple, meaning that you're not really intelligent. Simple means not complicated, that your soul is limpid, that it's like it's crystal clear, and there's no complications there for the devil to hide in. They lack that spirit of simplicity in believing in the many graces and the many ways that the Lord uses with the souls. Jesus said to me, I communicate myself both to the humble and to the simple. Now, all you've got to do is read the lives of all the saints you know, and that's the truth. Look at the extraordinary message given to Bernadette of Lourdes, who only walked into a school at the age of 11 in order to prepare for Holy Communion. That was the end of her schooling. Luisa Picaretta had no schooling. You find many of the saints whom the Lord has chosen. He has chosen them so that they were not influenced by the world, and therefore they could receive an incredible message from him. The humble and the simple. Look at the children of Fatima, the children of Garabandal, the children of La Salette, you know. Look at Luke chapter 1, verse 46. He pulls the mighty from their thrones and raises the lowly. I communicate myself both to the humble and to the simple or the lowly, because they immediately believe in my graces and take them into great consideration, though they may be ignorant and poor, ignorant meaning have no schooling, and poor having no money, as was the case of Bernadette and so on. But with these others, who have all the education and the good background and all the rest of it, I'm very reluctant, because the first step which draws the soul near me is faith. He uses the word belief. That means a living faith. And it happens that these, with all of their knowledge and doctrine and even holiness, never come to experience even one ray of celestial light. Now, to me, that's utter and complete tragedy. So they have their university degrees and their professorships and their this and that's and the others, and they've written books and they're famous and their speeches and they've got big jobs in the church. But if they've never experienced even one ray of celestial light, don't you think they're the poorest of the poor? In other words, Jesus said, they walk a natural path and they never arrive at touching even slightly that which is supernatural. Well, that explains how priests and bishops and cardinals can go astray. They don't even touch the supernatural even slightly. This is also the reason for which, in the course of my mortal life, there was not one learned man, not one priest, one man of power among my followers. It was all the little people. But all were ignorant and of low condition, because these were humble and simple and also more disposed to make great sacrifices for me. So I want to give you 1 Peter 5, 5 to 9. I want to give you Matthew 5, verses 3 to 12. And I want to give you 1 Corinthians 1, verses 26 to 31, in which Paul says, now look at us. After the resurrection, the church is now on its feet. He says, who are the people whom the Lord is calling? Isn't it the poor? And so on. We know that the first 4 or 5 popes were ex-slaves, for example. May the 23rd, 1899. Here we have, again, Jesus comes back to detachment from oneself. An extremely important message. This time my adorable Jesus wanted to play a little bit. He would come, he would show that he wanted to listen to me, but as soon as I would begin to speak, he would disappear from me like a flash. And she says, oh God, what pain. While my heart was swimming in the most bitter pain of Jesus' distance, and it was almost a little restless, Jesus came back again telling me, what is it? What is it? Now be more peaceful and more calm. Speak, speak, what do you want? And the moment I spoke, he disappeared. I did as much as I could to calm myself, but no, after a while, my heart returned to being unable to give itself peace without its only and sole comfort, and maybe more than before. Coming back again, Jesus told me, my daughter, sweetness has the power of making things change their nature. Now, she doesn't show sweetness in his absence. She only shows sorrow and grief and disturbance. And he's trying to tell her to stop complaining. He's also trying to tell her that she must give him the freedom to come and go as he pleases. She's got to let him be free, whereas her instinct is to draw him close to herself and hold him close to herself and all the rest of it. And she's got to become more free than that. She's got to let him go. Now, that's going to be a hard lesson for Louisa. So he said, sweetness has the power of making things change their nature. It knows well how to convert bitter into sweet. Therefore, more sweet, more sweet, he said. But he gave me no time to say a word because it wouldn't be sweet, you see. And so this is how I spent the morning. After this, I felt I was outside of myself. Together with Jesus, there were many people, some who aspired to riches, some to honour, some to glory, and some even to sanctity. But many other things, but not for God. This is very interesting. You might want to be a saint, but it's for yourself that you want to become perfect and you want to be famous and you want to be canonized and you want to be have a great place in heaven. What about God? What about God's glory? It's all about loving God. The whole thing is about loving God. And she said, so these people were, some of them aspired to riches, honour, glory, even to sanctity, but not for God. And rather to be considered someone. That's the important thing. In other words, even if they wanted to become saints, it was that they wanted to become someone special. Turning to them, shaking his head, Jesus says, foolish that you are. You are working your own net to entangle yourselves. It's very sad. John 5:44, Jesus said, you look to one another for approval and you don't seek the approval of the one God. Then turning to me, he told me, my daughter, this is why the first thing I recommend is detachment from all things, also from yourself. In other words, you're not looking for your own sanctity. You're not looking for your own this, that or the other. When the soul has detached herself from everything, she has no need to struggle in order to stay away from the things of the earth, which by themselves come round her. In other words, we're on the earth, so you have to be surrounded by the things of the earth, but it's not going to affect you if you're really free. But rather in seeing themselves ignored and even more despised, saying goodbye to her, they take leave of her and they don't bother her anymore. So if you've become free of something, it's not going to bother you. The amazing thing is that when I turned off the radio more than 20 years ago, I don't even think radio. Not only do I not think I'm missing anything, but the word itself doesn't come into my head. But all the peace and freedom and everything else that you get by not having all these voices coming in on top of you with all the different opinions of the world. Oh, that's wonderful. Do you miss that? No, you don't. What you find is that you've shut off that cacophony of voices and you've allowed yourself the freedom to hear the voice of God. So May the 26th, 1899, contempt of oneself must be united to faith. So this is a message in which we're talking about true self-knowledge. This morning, I was in such a state of annihilation of myself, Louisa says, to the point of feeling obnoxious and annoyed. It seemed to me that I was the most abominable being that could be found. I saw myself like a little worm that tossed and turned, but remained always there in the mud, unable to take a step. Oh God, what human misery. Yet after I have been given so many graces and still so bad. So put John 15:5 there. Without me, Jesus said, you can do nothing. I think we've all proved that one. Without him, we can do nothing except sin. My good Jesus, always kind with this miserable sinner, came and he told me, contempt of yourself is praiseworthy when it is well invested with the spirit of faith. Now, contempt of yourself when it is not invested with the spirit of faith can be very dangerous because it could lead you to suicide. And contempt of oneself is that not only are you not blowing yourself up, you are simply not giving yourself the attention that others give themselves. And when it is well invested with the spirit of faith. But when it is not invested with the spirit of faith, instead of doing you good, it will harm you. In fact, In seeing yourself as you are, unable to do anything good, you'll become discouraged, disheartened. And of course, that leads to suicide in people who have no faith, without daring to take one step on the path of good. But by leaning on me, that's your Philippians 4:13, I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. That is, by investing yourself with the spirit of faith, you will come to know and despise yourself, and at the same time, you will come to know me, confident of being able to do anything with my help. That's exactly what Paul says in Philippians 4:13. I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. And here is how, by acting in this way, you will walk according to the truth. Louisa said, how much good these words of Jesus have done to my soul. I understood that I must enter into my nothingness. Now, you see, this is the important bit. OK, so I think it would be good to write nothingness at the top of the page here. To enter into my nothingness and know who I am, but I must not stop there. Rather, immediately after I have known myself, I must fly into the immense sea of God and stop there. When a child feels weak or challenged or has cut its knees or dirties its clothes or whatever, what does it do? Run straight into the arms of its mother. And the Lord wants us to run straight into his arms. He is everything we are not. Okay. Rather, after I have known myself, I must fly into the immense sea of God and stop there to draw all the graces that my soul needs. Otherwise, my human nature becomes weary and the devil will look for the opportunity in order to cast you into discouragement. And discouragement is a terrible place to be. May the Lord be always blessed and may everything be for his glory. So we'll do another one. May 31st, 1899. Opposition serves so that the truth may shine. In other words, when we're serving God, you can expect opposition, but the Lord uses it. This morning, as I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus came. And at that very moment, I saw the confessor. Jesus appeared a little disappointed with him because it seemed that the confessor wanted everyone to approve that my situation was a work from God and almost wanted to convince other priests by showing them something of my interior. Jesus turned to the confessor and said to him, "This is impossible. Even I received opposition, and I received it from the most distinguished people, also from priests and other authorities. They found fault with my holy works," as John 8:48, "aren't you a Samaritan and a devil?" "To the point of saying that I was possessed by the devil. But I allow these oppositions, even from religious people, so that the truth may shine in its own time." Now, that's the important bit. See, the opposition is going to be good for Louisa's own growth. But we who are living a century afterwards can see that all the signs of authenticity are there. If you want to consult with two or three priests among the most good and holy and also the most learned in order to receive enlightenment and also to do what I want in the things to be done, which is advice from the good and prayer, this I allow. But the rest, no. It would be as though wanting to waste my works, making fun of them, which displeases me very much. And then he said to me, "All I want from you is an upright and simple way of working. Do not bother about the pros and cons of creatures. Let them think what they want without being in the least troubled, since wanting that everything be favourable is wanting to deviate from the imitation of my own life." Now, this is extremely important. Jesus is telling us, look, if you're going to live a spiritual life, you will find opposition. That's just the way it is. But if you're going to bother that your neighbours don't approve of you or somebody doesn't think you're the greatest thing that came upon the planet, if that's going to bother you, then you are not free enough to serve God. And so Jesus wants us to be completely free. it doesn't matter if someone doesn't think you're authentic when you know you are. The little bit of humility again will actually do you good. And so let everybody think what they want. And whatever you do, don't defend yourself. Don't defend yourself. Let them do what they want. And let God do what he wants. That's the beautiful thing. So we have to be free to really let God be God. So I'm going to stop there just now.